Today is Monday, January 15, 2018. This is a part three interview with Michael St. Clair. My name is Tom Martin. This is a Grand Canyon Oral History recording. And Michael, thank you so much for your willingness to head off into a part three interview here today. May we have your permission to record this conversation?
Of course.
Thank you very much. At the end of part two, we were talking about your first Grand Canyon River trip, and I wonder if you could pick that story up again.
Sure, but maybe before I do, I should correct something we talked about in the last one, which was the guy that had been the deputy sheriff down in San Juan County that I met on a cat trip in 76, and I think he later became the sheriff because the sheriff died or left office for some reason. Anyway, this guy, who I believe was one of the formulators of Wild Rivers in Bluff, his name actually is Verle Green, V-E-R-L-E-G-R-E-E-N.
What else do you remember about him?
Well, anybody who ever met him, his distinguishing characteristic was that he had a hair lip. But he was quite a character, Jack Mormon. And as far as I know, he ran out of Bluff little San Juan trips with just a collection of old Navy 10-mans and basically about anything that would float. And he ran from Sand Island down to Mexican Hat, or from up above, Montezuma Creek comes in. And I think those trips started as just kind of family affairs or friends and family. And people liked him so much that he actually started up Wild Rivers with some other folks.
Okay.
So that was Verle's story.
Cool, Verle, thank you.
Verle hung around a long time, and after he retired from the sheriff's department, kind of got stove up in the 90s. He used to drive his car down to the waiting or the visitor center that's just outside of Hole in the Rock on Highway 191 between Monticello and Moab. I don't know if you know the spot.
Yeah.
There's a nice little park there.
Yes.
And Verle would just set up a picnic table and put a cooler on it with a six-pack and sit there and drink a beer and wait for somebody to come by and then talk to him. In those days, just about everybody who had any reason to go up and down Highway 191 and stop at the rest area, you know, knew Verle. So there was carrying on. But yeah, that was the story was, if you wanted a beer and wanted to talk to Verle, just drive out to the rest area.
Wow.
Anyway.
I bet he had some stories.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I'm sure he did. And I would periodically drop by and just say hello. But, yeah. Back to the first grand trip in late September, October of 1977. I was kayaking at the time. I had a fiberglass Hyperform Mark IV, a real one, not one that had been molded. They were a real popular boat, and a lot of people took molds of the hulls and made their own. But this was a genuine article, but it was fiberglass. And the impressions I had of the canyon were mind-boggling, which I think anybody in a little boat would have. I remember swimming the Paria Riffle, which wasn't an auspicious start.
Unintentional swim?
Yeah.
Oops.
Well, I remember I was catching an eddy, and I caught an edge, and I wasn't ready, and it was, you know, the first 15 minutes or something, and I ended up swimming. I think it was eye-opening, and I think it didn't become my mind-boggling until we got down into the 20s. And then I started thinking, wow, this is just, you know, I've never seen anything like this anywhere. because it's just spectacular. And we had perfect weather. I don't remember it raining on the trip at all, but it may have. I do remember that the water was clear, and I remember Greg Williams catching the 14-pound trout down at Redwall.
Wow.
Which was when he came carrying it back to the boat, it stretched from his waist down to the ground. That's how big it was. So
wow.
That was pretty impressive.
So,
but unfortunately, before we got to Redwall, a fellow named Michael Barrett from Aspen, and he at the time owned a ski lodge in Aspen, actually more like a hostel. But Michael later went on to own Horse Thief Ranch out in Canyonlands.
Hmm.
After he sold his property in Aspen, he bought Horse Thief, and he just sold Horse Thief about 6 months ago.
Hmm.
But Michael swam in 24 or maybe the rapid they now call Georgie's. I don't remember. But he was right in front of me, and he swam, and he separated his shoulder.
Hmm.
And we got into shore and went into camp, I think at 24 and a half, but it might have been below 25. I can't distinctly remember, but it was before the end of the 20s, and it was sort of a premature end to the second day. So we found the camp and pulled over on the left-hand side, and the next morning, or maybe that night really late, Stan Hollister, who was on the trip, and Bob Miller hiked out to the highway to get a chopper, and the next day we moved downriver to the best chopper landing spot and evacuated Michael. Last name is Behrendt, B-E-H-R-E-N-D-T. At any rate, I was pretty impressed. They had talked to me about whether I wanted to go down and hike out with them, but two was enough, and three was just going to be, you know, excess. So these guys hiked out to the road and stuck their thumb out and caught a ride, I think, to Bitter Springs or somewhere with a phone, and then called in the helicopter.
Yeah.
So the helicopter came in early the next morning and grabbed Michael and took him on his merry way, and we proceeded on downstream.
Did the helicopter bring Stan back?
Yeah, brought okay. Stan and Bob back. And they got out and Michael got in.
Got it.
So we kept going, and we got down to the Little Colorado 2 days later. I think we camped at Nankweep and then we went on down. And we're all sitting at the Little Colorado having lunch and going and playing in the slide and having fun, and all of a sudden we hear a helicopter, and here comes Michael back in.
Wow.
He had to pay for that one, but still, it was, you know, it was pretty neat. And at that time, I had my kayak up on the tail dragger up on the 33, because it's pretty much flat water around there, and I don't know, I probably was tasked with fixing lunch or something, but anyway, and so he comes clambering across the gear pile on the 33, and my kayak is lying there, and he steps right on the roaming in front of the cockpit, and I'm the only one that sees it or hears it, and there's this distinct, you know,
crack,
and I go, oh no, and he doesn't even stop, he just keeps going because he's coming to the back of the boat to say hello to everybody. And I just go, oh shit, you know, and I couldn't tell him, and I never did. But that night, a patch in my boat, he finally comes around and goes, oh, what happened? I go, oh, I don't know.
Gosh.
I don't think he knows to this day, but
let me ask you about that Mark IV. Did it have a seat?
Did it have a what?
A seat?
Yes, it did. We used to call it the seat designed by refugee Nazi doctors. because the way the seat, it was suspended from the cockpit. Roaming. And the way the back of it kicked up, if you left it stock, your spine would just go numb after about, 15 minutes.
Wow.
So what you had to do was take a hacksaw blade and cut the back inch or inch and a half off in sort of a moon shape or sliver of a moon shape to relieve the pressure on your spine when you sat in it.
Okay.
And then you could kind of make it comfortable with padding and, you know, things like that. The other thing we did, which Hertzler taught me, was we seamed the inside seam, which was a real chore.
Yeah.
But you took a 2-inch roll of fiberglass tape and mixed up your resin, and you got a broom handle or a stick that was 3 or 4 feet long. You put a nail in the end, and you sand the inside seam as much as you can and get it clean, and then mix up your resin, dip your fiberglass in the resin, put the end of it on the hook, and lay it down as far as you can from tip to tip. And that made it really a lot stronger and stiffer. I had that boat until it fell apart, and I hit a bunch of rocks broadside, and I never had to patch the seams, which is really unusual for those boats. And I did have to patch other little things and stuff like that. But
What kind of spray skirt did it have?
We had actually real rubber spray skirts in those days.
Okay.
Neoprene. There's a fellow in Pennsylvania named Charlie Walridge, who you probably have heard of.
Yep, sure.
And Charlie, back in the 70s, was selling mail-order glue-it-yourself kits for wetsuits and spray skirts and probably other stuff, and I bought one of his kits for a wetsuit top, and I wore it till I got too big for it, and it worked fine. But he would send you everything you had to with a pattern, and you had to cut the neoprene to your pattern and then glue the edges, and they were pretty slick, and about, you know, a third the cost of trying to find something ready made, which was already difficult.
Yeah. Wow.
So, yeah, and we used, I mean, we had nylon spray skirts, too, for paddling on lakes and stuff. But, yeah, we actually had, in those days, still real neoprene.
Did you see anyone else on the trip that time of year? This was September, October.
I don't recall seeing one other trip the whole way.
Okay.
I'm sure there were other people down there, but, you know, we may have just been
ahead or behind
on the right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And how many days, do you remember how many days your trip was?
I think it was 17 or maybe 18 to Diamond Creek.
Okay.
It was longer than your normal. I remember that because we were in the shoulder season and because we just wanted to make it longer, I guess. It was about, I want to say 25 people all together.
Okay.
And about half kayakers and half in the 33, and Stan had an old Havasu, I think, or maybe it was an old Avon, and anyway, there was at least one rowboat I remember, and the 33, and then about 10.
Did you swim further down in Marble Canyon, or was the Paria your only?
Oh, no. I swam most every day.
Were you getting better as you went along?
That would be difficult to say. I was getting better at swimming, yeah.
There you go.
I did my first river roll somewhere down there because Baker kept telling me I needed to practice. And the problem was that the water was so cold, and it wasn't all that warm, you know, temperature-wise. I mean, it was fine. It was sunny and nice, but, you know, temperatures in the 70s and 80s, and then the moment you ducked your head into that water, it was like, oh, my Jesus.
Yeah.
So I didn't like practicing, and even when we got to camp, if I could sneak off and try to do a few in an eddy that was a little warmer than anything else, that didn't work too well either. But, yeah, I remember hitting my first roll in the river down there with Baker yelling at me to keep my head down. So,
right.
But, yeah, I swam basically by big, including lava. But it was maybe lowish water, I would say.
Okay.
The low lows were maybe 3,000, and the highs were maybe 8 or 10.
Oh, wow. That's not super high
yeah.
for the dam release.
Right. This was before they had decided how to regulate the flows in accordance with the science, which sometimes I wish it was a fish, because that's who's actually benefited from that whole scheme.
Mm.
Or a fisher.
that 3 to 8 was a daily event?
Pretty much. It was worse on the weekend.
Okay.
But yeah, it was pretty much every day. Some big fluctuations. I know, because it was part of the duties to try to keep an eye on the boats at night. And if they were dry in the morning, it was you who got yelled at or
right.
organized the people to push them back.
And that must have been a fairly difficult job for Williams in the tail dragger in the 33-foot tube there, because 8K is low to start, and then anything less than that's gonna.
Yeah, it was. He put one about 2-foot gash in it down. I don't remember exactly where, but somewhere. Mill Gorge area before Deer Creek, and we had to sew it up that night and glue it and everything.
Okay.
But otherwise, he did pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
He ran soft. In those days, that was a pretty good idea.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, with water that low, sure.
Yeah. So, anyway, the rest of my memories of that trip are basically just, being awestruck and saying, I need to get back down here. There were places I recognized sort of from the river that I had been to on the rim or down from the rim and stuff, but not a lot. I mean, there was the obvious landmarks of Desert View and, when we got to Phantom, you could walk up on the north side towards the Clear Creek Trail and look back over to the South Rim and things like that. But it was just the whole. I don't think we'd be talking if you hadn't had the same reaction at some point.
Sure.
You come around a corner and there's just the most beautiful vista you've ever seen in your life. And at that time, I was young enough that I just wanted to see it and see more of it.
Hmm.
Later on, when you get a few years on you, you sort of wish you could stop time for a second and just have that in your heart and in your mind forever. But at being that young, it was sort of, okay, well, this is cool. What's around the next bend? Anyway, there wasn't any real emergencies or urgencies other than Michael's evacuation for his shoulder. I do remember it did rain on that trip, because it was the night before we were taken out at Diamond, and we were down at maybe mile 220 or 221, and it just let loose buckets. And in the middle of that rainstorm at like 9 or 10 at night, we all heard Kirk Baker and his girlfriend in their tent get into an argument, and you could just hear this bass voice and then this soprano and then this bass response and then this soprano. And so all of us who were around the tent were kind of waiting to see who came out. And sure enough, after about 10 minutes, the zipper comes down and out comes thrown out as a pad and then a sleeping bag. And there's Kirk standing there. So, that was pretty funny. Livened up a otherwise boring rainstorm. I think he slept under the table in the kitchen that night. But yeah, that was the last night of the trip, and it didn't seem so terrible at the time. I mean, when you got up in the morning, you were at mile, I think it was 220. We were on the right side there, the big camp.
Yeah, that's right.
And I think when we got up in the morning, the rain had let up, had gone, and it was sunny, and there was steam rising everywhere.
Wow, yeah.
That's a really cool sort of thing, so that kind of made up for a soggy night.
Nice.
And we went on down to Diamond Creek and took out.
So at that time, your litigation had been filed,
mm-hmm.
and no decision had been made yet. The management plan was going to be finally released in 79, but by then the courts had made their decisions. Can you kind of tie all that up for us?
Well, the management plan was still being tweaked and torqued and fine-tuned. There were still opportunities for input, but I think the public hearings were over with by 77 or 78. There may have been a few on various aspects, but again, there's the two, it was a kind of bifurcated process at that time, because there was the river and then there was the backcountry. And the Park Expansion Act had been passed back in, I think that was 75 or...
That's right.
So. And so, yeah, so you had the fallout from that in terms of, I mean, the Hualapai, the Havasu, the Pai, whatever, you know,
mm-hmm.
Paiutes, whatever you want to call them, they all had new boundaries and also new interests, let's put it that way. The Havasu were really the only ones that had an ongoing tourist, or if you want to say concession operation, and that was just limited to a few mules that they were dragging tourists down from the rim to the village. As far as I remember, the Hualapai didn't have any river operation at the time. I know Pete Resnick is the one that helped get that started. And I think that was about 79 or 80 before they got going with that. But, the Hualapai did have an eye on Diamond Creek, because you could actually drive in from Pete Springs and go for a picnic if you wanted to go down that horrible road. So they had a bulldozer, and they had, sort of a regular process for keeping track of who was going in and out of Diamond Creek. Because I remember with the Prescott College trips, even back in 70 and 71, we would stop at the tribal headquarters, I guess, in Peach Springs, and pay them some fee for going up and down the road and tell them we were going in. And the reason that you did that was, if it rained and the road got washed out, then they needed to send somebody down the road to
right.
grab the bulldozer and fix it. You know? But it was pretty informal in those days. So with the tribes having more of a stake, if you will, in what was happening in the canyon, the planning process for the CRMP and the wilderness proposal kind of spread out to try to grab, you know, some of that input. That's pretty wishy-washy summary of it, but I honestly don't remember a lot of specifics. I do remember that Fred and I went up to the South Rim at some point and had a meeting I want to remember who was heading up the river unit in that days, but I cannot, and I don't have a reference to grab onto. But I remember it was just a nothing meeting that Fred and I both came out of it going, well, this, we're not getting anywhere with this. You know? And I think the assistant park superintendent was there. It was like a half an hour meeting. You know, these are our concerns. This is why we're here, you know, blah, blah, blah. And they're, okay, thank you. Goodbye. it wasn't Nathaniel Reed. It wasn't, and it wasn't the park superintendent. It was, you know, some people who were obviously, you know, involved and important to the park there. But
right. I'm trying to think about mid-70s, George Vanderlippe was the chief ranger. But he left. He left right in there. So, and the superintendent would have been Merle Stitt, I believe, before.
Yeah, Merle was the superintendent. Yep.
Okay.
That's right.
And I'm not sure who deputy would have been.
Yeah, I don't. Anyway, it was not a significant. I mean, nothing significant emerged from it, other than the park said, "Yeah, we know your position." Basically,
okay.
from the lawsuit. But
had you hoped to maybe, you know, kind of talk with them a little bit and just see what they were going to do? You would withdraw your suit if it looked like they were going to readdress the allocation issue, or was it just kind of a fact finding for you guys to go up and see where they were at?
We were trying to see what they were thinking.
Okay.
To use that, you know, to talk to our constituency, small as it was, or whatever.
Hmm.
But it was not as collegial an environment in those days as it is today, let's say, you know, or inclusive would be the
mm-hmm.
word today.
Okay.
It was polite.
Good.
And there wasn't a lot of, you know, shouting or screaming, but
right.
there was, it was plain to us that the park was going to see where the winds were blowing. And we knew that there were park personnel who were adamantly supporting wilderness. I mean, all you had to do was have a beer with some of the folks who lived up at the South Rim after hours to find out, you know, what they really felt. And I would say most, at least of the backcountry unit, was pretty vocal proponents for, yeah, this should all be wilderness.
Uh-huh.
You know, including, and in the river side of the house, including the river rangers. But once you transitioned from the slaves to the quote management unquote, there were other concerns.
You know, one of the people you might have met with could have been Steve Martin.
Oh yeah, that's who it was.
Okay.
Yeah. That name rings a bell. But
because he was working on the plan there.
Uh-huh.
And he would leave once the park got its marching orders from Congress, but would come back as superintendent later on. So,
right,
yeah.
Well, I don't. I'm not sure marching orders from Congress is precisely right about the fallout from Hatch's Rider. I think it was marching orders from the Department of Interior.
Ah, sure.
Which was, we're not going to jeopardize all of our operations for one little, you know, idealistic principle in one park.
Right, and there was a shift as well in politics in D.C.
Right.
With the election of Ronald Reagan, President Reagan, and his appointment to Secretary of Interior, which was James Watt.
Right, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I think that, I mean, actually, not Reagan's election, but as what a snake in the grass what was emerged, I think there was a surrender by the park to the political realities.
Hmm.
I mean, I think I'd have to go back and look, but I think Watt took a river trip and actually helicoptered out
early. Yes, that's right.
So, I mean, it's, you know, the folks that I met over all of the years that are working in the Grand Canyon or on the rims, and whether they're working for the park or whether they're working for the Historical Association or whether they're working for the outfitters or whether they're working for the concession or whatever, almost everybody, they're not there for the job.
Right.
They're there for the canyon. And there's very few of them who want to see more development and more money, more roads, more vehicles, more traffic. So in many ways, it's a pretty friendly constituency. And it's just unfortunate that the hierarchy of the park then, and I don't know anything about the hierarchy today, but then they were still career oriented, and in order to keep moving up, you have to serve the political masters in Washington, or at least not piss them off.
Yes, sure.
So anyway, we continued to meet and keep a finger on the process during 78 and 79. At some point, I got down there on a commercial trip, rowing again through Greg, but for the life of me, I can't remember. It might have been an oar trip. I remember the boat. I remember it was right when we were transitioning from using rope to using webbing to tie everything in.
Would this have been when you spoke with Mike Walker about doing a baggage trip?
It was before then, because okay. Mike hadn't gotten to Flagstaff yet. But Greg knew George Wendt, and a lot of different people knew George, and somehow I got hooked up. I'm pretty sure it was an oars trip. I remember the boat. And like I say, I remember the part about the webbing versus rope, because I was really jealous of the guys that had webbing. They were rigged about 10 times faster than the rest of us. But it was a blur because it was, I think, 14 days to Diamond.
Okay.
And it was, it was put down the miles kind of trip. Or pull into camp and go to work.
Yeah. You don't remember who the oars warehouse manager was at the time?
The warehouse manager, it wasn't Mike yet. I'd have to look. Okay. I might have his name somewhere. I can sort of see somebody, but I can't put a finger on a name for the life.
No worries. Just want to check. Who else was on that trip, 78, 79? Do you remember?
Oh, Jesus. Bago, maybe?
Okay.
And
B-A-G-O?
Gebhardt. And maybe Mike Jacobs from Moab. I think that's how I got on the trip. Mike later died in an accident in North Canyon.
Yeah.
And I had met Brian Coombs in Moab, and Brian and I became pretty good buddies later on in 80, 81, ran a bunch of trips in CAT together.
What do you remember about Jacobs? Didn't Michael, didn't he fall across from Blacktail on a Mokibak trip? Or am I confusing him with somebody else?
No, I thought it was in North Canyon, but Michael was a good climber. That's basically what he went on river trips for, was to get away one afternoon and go climb something. He lived in this little house behind John Williams' house in Moab.
Okay.
With a girl who later went on to become a ranger in Canyonlands and elsewhere, Barbara Warren, I think, W-A-R-R-E-N. And I'm pretty sure Michael's one that got me on the oars trip. I don't remember who else, but it, like I said, it was a lot of work and not much time to really kick back and enjoy the scenery. So by 78, I was basically going up to Moab, living in Prescott, but going up to Moab every summer, sometimes early, and working out of Sidewinder. But I did other trips for other folks and drove shuttles and did just about anything. I mean, Moab was maybe 500 people in the winter, maybe 1,500 in the summer.
Mm-hmm.
That was good.
Yeah, small.
Yeah. There was one real traffic light and one blinking light. in those days. But there was a bunch of different companies around there, some of which are no longer around. North American, Outlaw Trails, which was A.C. Ecker's outfit.
What do you remember about A.C.?
I remember that every time I saw him, which was maybe a dozen times altogether, mostly at put-ins or takeouts or in town, he always had blue jeans and cowboy boots on, whether he was on the river or in his truck. He was a character, you know, a hail fellow, well met kind of guy. He'd recognize everybody and come over and say hello. And he was one of the first, I'm not going to say the first, but along with Mitch Williams at Tagalong, he was one of the first to link up like Jeep trips and river trips. So one of his selling points for his companies was that you could go for 3 days in a Jeep out in Canyonlands and then come back and take a 4-day river trip or 5-day river trip.
Okay.
And that was quite frankly, at that point, I was looking to make a living.
Mm-hmm.
Or be able to keep my truck in relatively good shape. So there was more opportunity. I remember in the late 70s, 78, 79, 80, a lot of the clientele in Moab and in the Grand was European, because the exchange rate between the dollar and the various euro currencies was favorable.
Yeah.
So there were a lot more Europeans coming over and taking trips than previous. And also, I think the word was just getting around.
Hmm.
Today, there's a lot more people from the Far East, particularly China, and to some extent from Japan and stuff. But, back then it was the Euro weenies, as some people referred to them. So, anyway, the lawsuit percolated along, and I would periodically call Fred. We didn't see each other for a couple of years in there somewhere, or maybe a year and a half. And I just kind of kept tabs on where it was, which was we had lost and appealed, and the appeal was turned down and lost, and then resurrected. It wound its way through the courts, all the way to the Supreme Court, and then the Supreme Court refused to review the lower court findings, which were the case that sunk us, the precedent that sunk us, was this silly lawsuit in, I think, the late 20s, 1920s, about bus companies on the National Mall in Washington. And reading the case, what I could basically surmise was that tourism had just started to take off with people wanting to come to Washington and see the sights. And there were competing open bus, kind of the London double-decker style buses, up and down Constitution Avenue and around the mall that offered trips for people to go see the sights.
Okay.
The Washington Monument, the Lincoln Memorial, blah, blah, blah. And, of course, the White House and Supreme Court, all the whole nine yards, which I later saw too much of. But so somehow it got to be a mess, and I don't know who sued, but the ruling was that the Park Service had the right to award concessions to qualified operators in order to provide access to the public. And that is what sunk us, because somehow that wording of providing access to the public got cut and pasted into access to parks, or just public access, you know, in general. There was a linkage between concession and public access.
Okay.
And that remains, as far as I know, the case today. There is still that connection. And the outfitters make it vehemently that they are the ones that are providing access to the public, and private users are this elite group that can afford to go and, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
So.
Interesting. Okay. So that would have hurt, except that the park also came forward with, instead of a 92.8, came forward with a roughly 70-30
yeah.
split in access. So they greatly increased the do-it-yourself access.
Right.
How did you guys look at that? What did you think? Because here's you lost in court, and yet what you were looking for, which was greater access,
right,
seemed to happen.
Well, there were a couple of things around that. I mean, there was never some night when Fred and Dick Hertzler and I sat around and sort of mused on this, but there were times when I went out to his place in Scottsdale or saw Hertzler up in Prescott and we would talk. You have to understand that by the time the CRMP was announced and implemented 79, 80, 81, the outdoor revolution was going on and everything was changing. Kayaks were made out of plastic. I tested some of the first fiber clothing for Yvon Chouinard. He sent me a jacket that I wore, and I had to go back. Gore-Tex, which we would call Gay-Tex because it didn't work. But what was happening was, in virtually every aspect of the outdoor experience, whether you were a climber or a hiker or a boater, skier or mountaineer, whatever, name it, there was an explosion in gear that made the experience available to a lot more people. All of a sudden, a lot of the uncomfortable aspects of wool and wood
mm-hmm.
had been removed from the river running experience, at least. And in every aspect, I mean, I know my pack went from 50 or more pounds to like 35 was plenty. And that extended to the numbers of people who were interested in boating. The very, very, very first self-bailers were kind of pathetic experiments up in Oregon. And I remember seeing one of them up on a trailer and going, why would you put holes in the bottom of your boat?
Right, right.
Or as my friend Jensen says, self-fillers, not self-bailers. but I think that for whatever reasons, and you know, you'd have to talk to the park people to find out how they were thinking and why they wanted to, or why they agreed to increase the allocation. But it turned out to be pretty prescient because there were a lot more people, a lot more of us, by, like, say, 1985 than there had been in 1975. So the 30% share of the pie, even though it was accompanied with an overall increase in the use, placated to some extent the demand, let's say. again, I think all of this, if you're looking at it from the park perspective, all of this takes place against the backdrop of the political situation in Washington, which was pro-business and pro Let's just say it was pro business.
Okay.
So, you know, the outfitters never really had to give up anything. As a matter of fact, they all got increases. And we got an increase. And so from the park's perspective, we've made both constituencies better off, if not happy. We fixed this. Let's move on. And I think that's pretty much where it stayed until the late 90s when you and other folks went after them to get the CRMP started again when they abandoned it.
You know, one of the things that we missed, and it took us a while to figure out, and so I'm kind of wondering if this is something you missed as well. In dealing with a question of who gets to go, you can, as you say, you can placate a group by giving them more access, and the way to do that is to just carve that out of the sky and say, we're going to, you know, put more doors into the entrance to the movie theater.
Right.
And yet, what that does is it, you know, the park started the river management plan, planning process in the early, mid-70s because there were too many people. And the final dust settling in 1981 greatly increased the number of people. So that instead of reallocating use amongst the different groups of users, the park added more use on top of a situation that was already packed. Did that cross your threshold there of concern at the time?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Definitely, very definitely. But I think I've spoken previously, the science behind the determination of carrying capacity back in the 70s was very opaque. And it was also much more oriented to the questions that were on the questionnaire about the river experience in the 70s were stuff that was concerned with your perception of crowding and whether you saw other trips, how many, whether you felt like it was crowded, you know, blah, blah, blah. It wasn't directed to the environmental impacts very much. I mean, the obvious ones, the, for want of a better word, the shitholes and all the other stuff. I mean, the park would argue by 1980 or 81 that, yeah, we increased use, but we've spread it out. We've limited the number of launches per day. We've put in these environmental safeguards, groovers and kitchen procedures and fire pans and, you know, all this other stuff. That would be the park's response.
Sure. And those were great changes. The demand that the public pack out their own solid waste, the termination of building fires on the beach.
Right.
These were huge steps in a much needed direction.
Absolutely. But it wasn't lost on Fred, particularly, that the overall numbers were going way up.
Right.
It was about, as I remember, it was about a 50% increase overall. And there wasn't, I think, well, there were two things going on. One is I think people were weary and wanted to see if this new plan would work. And the other thing was that now more people could go, so everybody would fight for a little piece of the slightly bigger pie, rather than sort of go back and say, wait a minute. You know, I mean, for me today, you know, in 2018, this is the first year I'm actually having to think, maybe I shouldn't go this year. Maybe I should let somebody else go. Not because I don't want to, but because I've been fortunate enough to get down there many, many times, including the last 5 years in a row. And I think I know more about taking care of the place than I did 30 years ago. But at some point you have to say, okay, the thing is hammered and I should let it rest, or I should do my part to let it rest. Of course, the obvious response to that is, if you don't go, somebody else is going to go.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not an easy sort of intellectual wrestling match.
Well, at one point we just get too old. I mean, there's Dick Griffith,
right.
90 years old from 1951, his run of, yep, Lava Falls in a Rubber Boat. He was just down there this last year.
Yep.
And God bless the man.
Yep.
I think that's really neat. But again, we, not all of us, you know, as certainly as we get older, can continue to do the things we did when we were 20. So at one point you have to say, okay, what is my last trip? And,
right,
and what does that mean, for better or for worse?
Well, yeah, I talked in our last chat about Joy Ungridge and what, in many ways, an inspiration she was to me, because she's a little tiny girl who rode great big boats with the same or even better result as guys who were 6'4 and 220 with muscles in their eyebrows.
Sure.
Joy went on to contract colon cancer, which was diagnosed about 2 weeks after her honeymoon.
Oh my gosh.
By then I had moved on to join the Foreign Service. We were in Tanzania. It was 1989, 1990, and Joy and her new husband were going to stay in our house after they climbed Kilimanjaro. So they went off and climbed Kilimanjaro. We were moving. We never did see her. And about 2 weeks later, I called some friends in Salt Lake, and they said, well, Joy went in for her physical after she got back from Africa, and they found colon cancer. She was 40 years old.
Wow.
But Joy was, I would say, very well loved by her community of river runners. And she finally went on her last grand trip, I think in 94, 95, maybe it was even a little earlier. And it was written up in an article in Outside, which you might be able to find back when Outside was still paper edition. I don't even know if they are today. Anyway, the story of her last trip down the Grand Canyon was written up. And at the end of the trip, when they took out, everybody's saying goodbye, and they're all emotional because they know it's the last time they're going to see Joy. And she, at that point, had a bag and all kinds of problems. And she looked them all right in the eye and said, don't cry. One trip has to end so another one can begin.
Mm, yeah.
It's pretty difficult to contemplate never seeing the place that you love more than any other in the whole world. But I think you're right. Everybody's going to have to face that at some point. In my case, it's not physical decrepitude yet.
Good.
It's going to be, but it's not there quite yet. And again, it's the advances in boating. I finally found this boat that knows its way and lets me row it. So I'm perfectly happy and contemplating a trip this April. I'm not 100% sure I'm going to go yet, but okay, I've been invited, which is the first step.
Yeah.
So I, you know, I've been really fortunate in a lot of ways. And I remember when I was young, I used to say it's better to be lucky than rich. And I've been lucky. The river brought me my wife, and my wife kind of made me realize there's other things besides rivers. So I have no complaints. I do think there's a lot of injustice in the world, and there's a great deal of it in how we decide who gets to go where. compared to some of the grand things going on today, who should be allowed to go down the Grand Canyon is not going to engage very much of the public's interest.
Right.
So.
Yeah. Nice. Another question I wanted to ask you here was about Stan Hollister.
Oh, yeah. Stan, sorry.
No worries. No, this is very good. I really appreciate your reviewing the litigation, the concept, and sort of, you know, kind of where we are today, these issues are still with us. I guess I should probably tie that up, is one way of looking at this who gets to go issue in the bottom of the Grand Canyon, which seems like a very elitist subject, is as we move forward into the distribution of scarce resources, if we can come up with a equitable plan that is Solomon visionary, if you will, that may be helpful actually in federal land management making equally difficult decisions on who gets to go in the future at other places.
Absolutely. And I think the lottery concept has spread, whether it's because of the Grand Canyon model or other, but it's definitely spread everywhere. I mean, I entered the lottery for the Wave, which we used to call Coyote Buttes. I mean, I used to be able to walk in there when I would be driving back and forth between Kanab and Page or Kanab and the ferry or whatever. Mm-hmm. Now you have to enter a lottery. They give 20 permits, or they allow 20 people. And, you know, I haven't won it yet. I went down there for the in-person one last year. Didn't win that one either.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think that the whole concept of a lottery is the bureaucratic solution to the access issue. You know, what can be fairer than just pure luck?
Right.
Well, you know, I've got a lot of ideas about what can be fairer, but, you know, one of the more radical ones, is if you've been once, you shouldn't go again.
Okay.
They've tried that, too, in certain places. You get once in a lifetime. I mean, hunting, you know, you get one lifetime chance at a buffalo or Rocky Mountain sheep or, you know, any of a number of big game animals. So there's all kinds of things that are out there on the periphery that haven't really been looked at, and any combination of which might be a lot fairer or more equitable or just better for the resource. And I think that's what's lacking in the current system, is that the park has kind of lost sight of this unimpaired for future generations mandate that they have, which is a shame. You can't keep making people happy by making bigger pies.
Right. This is got to be really tough for the agency, for the Park Service, in that if their funding is being cut back and their personnel are shrinking and the demands for visitation are increasing, and they can put a fee on each person who shows up, then you have to balance impairment with operations. What a terrible place to find yourself as a park planner or manager.
I mean, when the whole issue of user fees came up, which I believe was back in the 90s, the first time.
That's right.
I was just furious. I mean, what happened with that was then the broad mass of the public became comfortable with, well, if you want to go see a national park, then you pay, you know, or if you want to use your national forest, then you pay, you know, rather than we're all in this together and it should be part of our taxes.
Right. It's a tussle between paying to play and public domain, the concept that these lands are held in trust for the public,
right.
not that they have to pay to go out there and visit what is theirs.
But, I mean, my wife and I still get out probably 30, 40 nights a year, and half of those maybe are in campgrounds. And now when I pull up to a campground and I see American Lands and Leisure signs, it makes me furious.
Mm.
I mean, you know, that used to be what you did when you joined the Forest Service. You cleaned the toilets, you maintained the campgrounds, you dealt with the public, you did all these things. And now, in that sense, the Reagan Revolution has succeeded, because we've decided that the best way to do all this is just turn it over to a private profit-making corporation and let them deal with all the headaches. Not really thinking through this about, you know, what the message you're sending and what the consequences of that is.
Right.
So, you know, I don't know how you make the world a better place other than to keep fighting. But I think when it comes to allocation in the Grand Canyon, we haven't got it right yet. And I probably the difference today from 35 years ago is I won't pretend that I know how to make it better.
Oh boy, I sure understand that.
But yeah, my righteous religious fervor has left. Mm. Abated.
Tempered by rational realism, I suppose.
Well, yeah, tapered by 40 years of scars and two children.
Yeah.
But back to Stan.
Please.
I got to know Stan in Moab. He had been working for an outfit up in Ontario. He was a Canuck. And he had been running great big boats down the Ottawa River on the Ottawa Daily. And I want to say it was something like Voyagers or... Anyway, when I was stationed in Ottawa, I went out to the outfitter who's still there. They have a camp on the Ottawa River where they launch from, or they take out at. And they have, you know, a ropes course and zip line and all kinds of stuff. And in the brief Canadian summer, they do pretty well. Hmm. Anyway, I went out there 30 years later to see if anybody remembered him, and nobody did. Of course, it had passed on, the ownership had passed on and stuff. But Stan, when he was in his 20s, had worked running both motors and these huge paddle rafts that had like 20 footers.
Wow.
Down the Ottawa. And I don't know how he got out to Moab or started running rivers, but he was a hatch boatman and came and ran trips for us at Sidewinder. In 78 and 79, both years in the late fall, like November, he and I did the science trips for Woodward Clyde, which is an engineering firm in San Francisco, and it was to see about siting nuclear waste disposal, which later became WIPP, W-I-P-P, that's in Nevada. But Stan was, he was sort of in the Chuck Carpenter mode of dirtbag, except he didn't drink, he didn't smoke, and he did also live out of a VW van, and he took fastidious care of his equipment. He had this old May West, and he would, when the Kapok would get punctured, he would spend an hour taking all the stitching out of the pouch, the one that was punctured,
uh-huh.
and open it up so he could slide the dead water log going out, and then he'd cut one off of a new jacket and put it in there because
wow.
he liked his old jacket, you know. And it had patches, and, I mean, various girlfriends would adorn it with embroidery and all this stuff. The park would give him no end of shit.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure.
About this jacket. And he would just smile and go, sure, okay, yeah, yeah, here's a good one. Here, I'll take this one. And then the moment he got on the river, he put his old jacket on, of course.
Right.
Anyway, Stan ran great trips. Tried to learn how to paddle a kayak, and he would use a kayak paddle that had no offset, no feather. And I tried to explain to him over and over that, you know, you wanted that offset because if you paddle into the wind, one blade is always going to be getting hammered, and it's just easier on your wrist. And he refused to believe it. He'd done too much canoeing. So he had this wooden kayak paddle that I think he made, and he just, you know, beat his head against the wall trying to learn to kayak, finally gave it up, realizing he wasn't destined to be a kayaker. He was great in the canoe.
I bet.
And he understood the river and stuff. But anyway, Stan and his, I guess it was 84. So in 83, which everybody thinks was the big water year because of what happened in the Grand Canyon Dam, 84 was actually, there was more runoff in cataract in 84 than there was in 83, higher runoff.
Yep.
And Stan had taken to swimming, rapids. He would go down with a couple of black bags with his gear and full wetsuit and flippers and swim. And in 83, he swam cataract at 61,000, I think.
Whoa.
But in 84, he tried it again, and they found his body down at the lake.
Right.
So he passed away. But he was quite a character. He was not real talkative, but always three or four steps ahead of everybody else on the trip. And he one of those kind of quiet, just very capable guys who, you know, if you ever did get into any difficulty, he was exactly the one you wanted along. So
nice.
Those are my recollections of Stan.
Nice. And Mike Walker, you mentioned that Mike was running oars when you showed up asking for a job one day. How did that go?
Well, it didn't go well. Because this would have been about 79 or 80. I think it was 80. As I recall, 79 was a really low water year. It was one of those years, it was either 78 or 79, when cat only got up to like 12,000.
Wow.
And
the typical average low is in the 30s for the pre-dam, pre-1960s spring runoff peak. Is in the 30s, so 12 is phenomenal.
Yeah. No, it was terrible. I think it was 79. But, because I remember rowing a lot to make very few miles.
Wow.
Anyway, I think it was 79. I decided the water's going to be this low. Maybe I should just go south and work in the Grand again, or try to. So I went to Flagstaff, and I think Mike had just become the warehouse manager for oars, and I went in and talked to him, and he basically said, well, you know, yes, I've heard of you, and you've got some references and this and that, but, you know, our training regimen is more or less you work three trips for free, and then if you pass approval, we'll pay you. And I said, well, geez. You know, these are long trips. I mean, the oar rowing trips in those days were 14 days to Diamond Creek, or 13 nights, 14 days, which means you have to pretty much stay on the sticks, and if the wind blows, you know, you're not going anywhere. And I said, well, geez, that sounds like an awful lot of work. And, you know, he goes, well, yeah, I mean, you get your share of the tips and whatever the group, you know, might make at the end, but we don't pay you an actual wage. And I said, well, you know, I can work other places and actually get paid. So that never came to fruition. I wasn't willing to work three trips for free. But there were people who were then and remain today. Last year, or no, in 2016, and this is probably a good story to conclude on. In 2016, I was down there on my son's permit, and the Dorys had come along, and they were camped at Stone. We went down, we wanted to get racetrack and do the Tapete hike, but we got the one across, because there was somebody in racetrack, so we got the one
talking,
on the left side.
Talking Heads.
Yeah.
On the left.
The big beach,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And the next morning, we rode over to Tapete's, and about half of our group made the hike around the Thunder River and down to Deer Creek. And the rest of us were hanging out at Tapete's, and I was making water because the pump had been turned off at Phantom, and we were getting pretty low on water. So I was pumping water with a big Katahdin, and in comes four dories. And it's a pretty small eddy to begin with there, and we had like four rafts in it, but we made room for them, and they were kind of typical dory folk, not much interested in us, which was fine. But they had to walk through all of us in order to get off on the hike. And so they pretty much all chased off and left one boatman behind. And that boatman was the guy rowing the baggage raft, a big 18-foot Sovtar piled with, 15 Paco pads and I don't know how much personal gear and all this other stuff. Anyway, it turned out he was the buddy with one of the guys on our trip who had gone off to make the hike but was only going to go a little ways up and then come back. He wasn't going to go all the way around. So the guy on our trip comes back and he sees his buddy and they start talking and having a beer out on the dories. And it turns out this guy rowing the baggage boat for the dories is a fireman in Montana. And he does a dory trip every year as his vacation and does not get paid. So I'm talking to him about why would you do this? I mean, he's in his 40s, mm-hmm. you know. And I'm saying, you know, why would you do that? And he goes, well, because, you know, Tom Martin and I have talked about this. I said, you know, people will do anything to get down here. And he said, well, yeah, it's that partly, but it's also a chance to, you know, be with the dory folk and all this stuff. Well, something set me off because as much as I admire dories and think they're beautiful, I think the best description of them is, again, from my friend Mark Jensen, gaily colored eggshells.
Yes, yes. Well done.
Mark would go on to tell you they don't haul anything. You can't keep a cooler in them. But I'll just call them gaily colored eggshells.
Good, yes.
So, you know, I tell him this, and he kind of reddens a little bit and starts defending dories. And just about then, here comes four more of the dories. And what they had done is their trip that had been camped at Stone, they had split the trip into the people who were capable of making the hike around and the people who were going to hang back and just hike up Stone and then go on down.
Got it.
So they pull in. There's four more dories that pull in. And about this time, I guess I'd had a beer or two, and I need to urinate. So I wade out into the river where the dories are all tied up. And there's now eight dories and four rafts in the Tapiz Eddy. Upper
crowded,
and so I'm sort of, you know, trying to be discreet, and the other dories are just talking to the couple of dory boatmen who had stayed behind, you know, about where they're going and what they're doing, where they'll meet up. And so I look over and there's this dory that I recognize called, I think it's the Vale of Rhiannon, Rhiannon, which is this waterfall in Ireland that Martin named one of his dories after.
Okay.
So I look at this boat and it's beautiful. Everything fresh. I mean, redone. Perfect. Spanking fresh paint and everything else. But there's this basketball-sized hole right at the waterline on the right side with this patch on it. And I do my business and go back to shore and start talking to this baggage boatman. And I go, well, that boat is gorgeous. I recognize the boat. And he goes, yeah, this guy spent all winter working on it and supposedly $3,000 to fix it, just the materials. And I go, wow, that's impressive. How'd that hole get in the side? He says, oh, just back up river here a couple days ago. It wasn't the boatman's fault, but the dory just got sucked over onto this rock. And I said, yeah, that's a shame. Anyway, they went on down to Deer Creek, and we went on down to Deer Creek. And when we got to Deer Creek, there were 12 private rafts that had each tied in singly to the shore. So almost the entire shore was taken up. Each raft tied off to the shore instead of double stacking them or anything. And then there were four dories. The other four hadn't come down yet. And then there were two Western rigs, S-rigs, the huge things.
Yep.
And when I pulled in, I was like, Jesus, you know. So I went all the way down to right where the water comes out of Deer Creek, which is really rocky, and that bar there. And I pulled in there, and I got our boats in there, and we double-stacked ours, even triple-stacked them, because we were basically empty. We were just waiting for our hikers to come around. And the Western boatmen, they had like 20 or 23 people on each boat, and their people were, I was sort of worried. You know, I had one hand on my first aid kit because these folks were not used to being out there, and they were clambering all around. You know, they had trouble just getting over the lines, the bow lines, to get over to see Deer Creek Falls. And I'm like, this is the most people I've ever seen here. So I go over to talk to one of the Western boatmen, who turned out to be a swamper, and he says, yeah, we got two more boats coming in. And I said, well, you're going to have to put them up above. There's no more room down here. And he goes, yeah, I'll go wave them in there. So two more Western boats come in, and they pull over up above the eddy at Deer Creek and send their people around over the rock.
Right. You know, yep. It's a good little scramble up there. Sure.
And I'm like, Jesus, you know. So anyway, by my modest estimation, there were 200 people at Deer Creek Falls. And all I wanted was for my hikers to get down so we could leave.
Right.
One of the private parties had decided that the place to eat lunch was right there on the ever-shrinking sandbar.
Hmm.
So they set up an umbrella and their tables and everything right there and had lunch. And I went over to talk to them and said, you know, maybe next time you consider take the best place to eat lunch. You know, I was trying to be diplomatic, which I already told you I'm not. And they just looked at me like I was from Mars. And I said, you know, if you don't mind 150 people walking through your lunch, then... Anyway, they didn't get it at all. And I was interested in where they were camping. So they said, well, we're going on down. We're going to try to get somewhere down towards Kanab Creek. I don't remember what they told me. Might have been Olo, which I would never camp in, but I didn't tell them that.
Right.
Anyway, so I thought, well, maybe I better go talk to these Western guys. So I found one of the boatmen from the Western trip, and I don't have his name, but he had red hair and weighed about 230 pounds and dwarfed me. So I said, well, what were you guys there? No, so he asked me. He said, where were you thinking of camping? And I said, well, we're going to try to take Poncho's kitchen. And he goes, oh, we were going to go to Poncho's. And I go, well, you know, there's the football field right below there. You could go there. And he goes, oh, no. Didn't they tell you at the orientation that the big camps are for the big trips and the little camp are for the little trips? And I said, no, as a matter of fact, they didn't tell me that. And he's looking at me. So then he decides he's not going to get anywhere with that line. And he sort of throws his arm around me and hugs me and goes, well, hell, we're all here for the same reason. And I said, no, we're not. You're here to make money, and I'm here because I've got to travel with my family. He did not like that.
Wow, good for you. It's good to know these things.
But that's the literal, you know, I mean, right there is kind of my whole experience in a nutshell. There's 200 people at Deer Creek, 100 of them are on four Western rigs, which they, quote, were running two separate trips, unquote. They want to shame me into giving them ponchos.
So how did that all work out? Did your people get in and did you get out of there down to ponchos before Western pulled out?
Yeah, it worked out perfect. Just about the time that the Western folks realized that I wasn't going to be cooperating, my hikers showed up. I grabbed them all, threw them in the boats, rode across the river and went into ponchos and was sitting there on the shore setting my kitchen up when they went by. So one of the Western groups did go into football. The other one went somewhere else.
Well, it would have been back at you right around the corner or headed on downstream for Doris or something else.
He was trying to talk me into going across the river to Deer Creek.
Oh, to across from Deer Creek.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
You know,
or OCs down below. Yeah. No, it's, and this is the issue. If you don't reallocate and you simply Meaning if you've got 100 chairs and you say, okay, well, 70 of these chairs are for you and 30 of these chairs are for you, we're going to reallocate. So now 30 of the chairs are only for the 70 people, and now 70 chairs are for the 30 people. That's not going to add more chairs to the room. But if you say, okay, we've got 30 chairs here and 70 chairs there, we're going to add another 50 chairs. So now we've got 80 chairs over here and 70 chairs over there. Well, right. Now there's, right. I'm sorry, there's 150 chairs in the room. And, right. And where do those 50 chairs go? So this is the dilemma we face today.
Yeah, and again, the one thing that hasn't changed is, and this goes back to the 50s as far as I'm concerned, your access is still mainly dependent on your economic status. Hmm. I mean, even back in the 50s, if you could afford it, you could get Norm Nevels or, you know, whoever was around, the Riggs brothers, to take you down the river. Now, you know, it was a lot cheaper then and a lot more participatory, which is, I think, the other side of this coin. But it's always been, and this may have been one of the arguments that the park used in the lawsuit, is that, you know, it's always been a matter of economics. Poor folks don't, except for Georgie and Allison or whatever, poor folks don't take river trips.
You know, that's exactly right. Georgie and Harry Ailson, in the 40s into the 50s, of course, Georgie didn't start her commercial stuff until the 50s, but Harry in the late 40s, he undercut Norm Nevels, who was charging $1,000 in 1942. And then if you kind of worked on Norm, he'd bring that down to 500. That's still a huge amount of money. At the time, Harry just undercut that incredibly.
Right.
So, you know, there's, and then, you know, Georgie did the same with her share the expense trips.
Yeah, and Ken Slight and others. There were right. Not all outfitters are, and this is the other side of the coin that a lot of private folks, including some of the people that we've engaged on Mountain Buzz, and I just don't think there's anything to be gained by casting the outfitters as evil, mm-hmm. and you know, with bad intentions.
Uh-huh.
A lot of them, including the Quists with Moki.
Oh, absolutely.
They care as deeply and you know about the resources we do. They're just coming at it from, you know, a family connection. And I mean, if I had been born with the last name Quist or Stavely or a lot of the other things, I would be just as adamant about the fact that what I'm providing is a service to the public as they are.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. No, certainly. Certainly. I get that. I get that they would say that. You know, you really have to dive deep into the details of all this to really start seeing there's some real questions to be asked and still to be sorted out for the future. So,
well, let's hope so.
Yeah. That's the plan. Michael St. Clair, thank you so very, very much for such a wonderful three-part interview. Today is Monday, January 15th, 2018. And I'm very, very grateful for your taking the time to spend with me as we talk about Grand Canyon and past management practices.
Well, thank you, Tom. And I hope it helps a little bit. I'm not sure it's worth transcribing, but it's up to you guys.
We'll leave that to the transcribers and see what they think. Hold the line for a minute.